for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, who's really responsible for the fact that Osama bin Laden's still running around loose? A new survey of Americans done by the Roper Organization, or excuse me, the Gallup Organization, suggests 53% of Americans say George W. Bush should have caught the guy. 36% of Americans, Bill Clinton, 11%, no opinion. Bill Clinton run amok on Fox News? Or was George W. Bush running amok when he was rather angrily responding to somebody who asked him about a national intelligence estimate and then essentially said he didn't buy it? You know,
I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and then, you know, kind of stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East.
Nope, sounds like he's going nuts to me. David Tebow is with us with the conservative cybercast news service, CNS.com. David, first of all, before we get into all this stuff, I know you've been going through a tough time here. You're waiting for, I hope you don't mind my talking about this on the air, first of all. David?
I don't mind if you talk about it on the air.
Okay, thank you. I know you're going through a tough time. You're having you're preparing for a bone marrow transplant, is that right?
That's the plan. I've already gone through some chemotherapy for treatment of leukemia, but I feel great today,
and
I even went running a couple of nights ago, so I think I'm going to beat it like a stick.
Baruch Hashem, thank God. You have been in my prayers, and I know many of our listeners, and we all wish you the best.
I want to say, Tom, that in addition to your own kind wishes, I received some emails and letters from your listeners who wished me the best, and I was a little surprised by it, and I am very grateful by it.
Well, we disagree with your politics, but you know, as a human being, you're a decent guy, and you've always, one of the things I really appreciate, David, is that you've always been straight up. I mean, yesterday, for example, I had a conservative talk show host on the program, and you know, we were debating the issue that you and I are talking about right now, and at the end he says well, the reason we should have invaded Iraq, and I'm paraphrasing, was because Saddam Hussein was celebrating 9/11. He says there was only two countries that were celebrating 9/11, Iraq, you know, Saddam Hussein and Afghanistan. And I was shocked because my memory was that Saddam Hussein had condemned 9/11, but I thought, this guy wouldn't lie to me. I mean, this is a talk show host that I know. And I thought, he wouldn't lie to me just to score points. And I was just, like, speechless for a moment, you know. And then we hit the break and we were out. And after we got off the air, you know, a couple hours later, I had time to go in and Google it and find that he'd lied to me. I mean, you've never done that. And I really honor that, the fact that we can disagree. And everybody likes to win an argument, but it's really ultimately about what the argument is.
Well, I appreciate that. And thanks for inviting me again today to debate, what are we talking about, the national intelligence estimate, I guess.
Yeah, and Bill Clinton and Fox,
right.
And just, you know, this whole, there's really a zeitgeist, a whole gestalt here, as it were,
right.
a whole issue of, first of all, Condi Rice yesterday, talking to the New York Post, which is also owned by Rupert Murdoch, coming out and saying, well, we were just as aggressive as the Clinton administration. But the fact of the matter is that Dick Cheney was put in charge of the counterterrorism task force, and when, you know, Dick Clark was essentially demoted in January of 2001, and they never even met until September of 2001.
Right. Well, I guess it depends on whether you believe that the Bush administration should have done as much in 8 months as the Clinton administration had an opportunity to do in 8 years, Tom, because the World Trade Center explosion, the first one in 1993, occurred right at the beginning of the Clinton administration. And as you know, there were additional attacks at the Khobar Towers and at the two African embassies in Kenya and Tanzania and the USS Cole in Yemen. And hardly anything was done.
Well, let's take those one at a time. I mean, Clinton responded quite aggressively to many of those things, and you know, the response from the conservatives was that he was trying to wag the moniker. I mean,
how did he respond aggressively, Tom?
Well, he went into Sudan and bombed that factory, thought he was going to get Osama bin Laden. He authorized the CIA to go into Afghanistan and try to assassinate Osama bin Laden. He convened a weekly meeting of the counterterrorism task force. He pulled together the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, all these agencies. They put together a series of plans. I mean, they stopped the millennial bombing plot. I mean, these guys were moving forward.
In retrospect, Tom, I think historically people are going to look back, despite Bill Clinton's temper tantrums on Fox, they're going to look back and say that he cared much more about the economy than about international policy and especially terrorism during his 8 years as president, that he didn't want to go there because it was a losing proposition and a very difficult proposition, and so he didn't go there.
Here's what the 9/11 Commission says on page 128. This is after December 4th, 1998, when Bill Clinton was given a presidential briefing that says, Bin Laden prepared to hijack U.S. aircraft and other attacks. Quoting the 9/11 Commission, quote, the same day, counterterrorism czar Richard Clark convened a meeting of his counterterrorism security group to discuss both the hijacking concern and the aircraft anti-aircraft missile threat. To address the hijacking warning, the group agreed that the New York airports should go to maximum security starting that weekend. They agreed to boost security at other East Coast airports. The CIA agreed to distribute versions of the report to the FBI and the FAA, and they passed it along to the New York City Police Department and the airlines. The FAA issued a security directive on December 8th, that would have been 4 days later, with specific requirements for more intensive air carrier screening of passengers and for more oversight of the screening process itself at all three New York airports. Now, that's what Clinton did when he got a memo like that. On the other hand, on August 6th of 2001, George W. Bush was given a memo which had a very similar headline, Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S., and this from the 9/11 Commission report, page 262, quote, we have found no indication of any further discussion before September 11th. This is from August 6th to September 11th, among the president and his top advisors of the possibility of a threat of an al-Qaeda attack in the United States.
The first overt provocation that the Bush administration received from al-Qaeda was on 9/11.
That's not true.
It's true.
The first overt provocation that the Bush administration received from al-Qaeda was a week after George W. Bush became president, was appointed by the Supreme Court, when the CIA and the FBI finally agreed that the bombing of the USS Cole was actually done by Osama bin Laden. And they handed that information off to George W. Bush, and he did absolutely nothing with it for 9 months.
But it happened during Clinton's watch.
And Clinton, as he said in his interview with Fox, he put together a plan to go into Afghanistan and try and take him out, and the only thing that prevented any kind of congressional authorization of that was that the FBI and the CIA had not yet agreed that Osama bin Laden was responsible for it.
He didn't find a way to do it. He didn't do it, and Bush did.
Bush didn't. I mean, he couldn't go in because he didn't have the FBI and CIA saying, yes, this is the guy responsible. You don't go, you know, bombing a country if your intelligence agencies don't say, yes, he was responsible. When Bush became president, the FBI and CIA both said, yes, bin Laden was responsible. And George Bush said, oh, well, you know, his family's given my family $1 billion. We're going to leave him alone.
Obviously, ridiculous.
I just made that up. You know,
that's so ridiculous. He had 8 years to take significant steps against al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden and didn't lift a finger. And Bush had not been overtly provoked. His administration had not until 9/11.
You don't think that the bombing of the USS Cole was a provocation?
There had not been an attack during Bush's presidency launched by al-Qaeda until 9/11. The Cole was during Clinton's presidency.
Okay, so I'm not saying
that the Bush administration shouldn't have done more during the first 8 months of its presidency, but if you want to
compare
what it did for 8 months compared to what Clinton did for 8 years, then you've got to inarguably say that Clinton did nothing, and that once 9/11 happened, Bush not only devastated the Taliban and al-Qaeda bases in Afghanistan, but then he went after them elsewhere in the world.
So you're suggesting, David, I mean, we can argue that last point as well, but we're talking with David Tebow. He's the senior editor of CNSnews.com. You're suggesting then that George Bush, when he came into office, when he was appointed by the Supreme Court in January of 2001, should have simply ignored everything that had happened before, because that's what he did essentially for the next 9 months.
Because he wasn't attacked a week after he came into office, he should have ignored what had happened. And I don't think he should have ignored anything that preceded his presidency.
Then why won't Republicans condemn him for that?
Why won't Republicans condemn Bush for the 8 months?
Yeah. For just sitting on his butt for 8 months. For Dick Cheney cutting deals with Halliburton in secret. He went all the way to the Supreme Court to keep him in secret when he never even once met his counterterrorism
task force. Well, the bottom line is that no significant action was taken against al-Qaeda except for intelligence beef-ups that had been diminished during the Clinton administration. But no significant military action was taken against Afghanistan, the Taliban, al-Qaeda, Iraq, none of it during the first 8 months of Bush's presidency. And you've got to say, point the finger and say, why not? But then you've got to point the finger at the Clinton administration and look at 8 years, not 8 months, and say, why not?
Well, and Bill Clinton is the first to say, he said, I failed. I failed to get it.
Sure did.
Although he said, he did try. And I think you have to give him that, David.
I don't think he tried. I think he wanted to focus on the economy.
All right. Well, that's where we'll agree to disagree. David Tebow, CNSNews.com. Thanks a lot for being with us, David, and good luck on your recovery.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I've been working on vacation, chasing hares and moles. Cindy Sheehan notwithstanding, and I never read the polls. What's the point? I've made no mistakes I know of. That's just not like me. I subscribe to presidential infallibility. Intelligent design, the notion seems divine. Science must be wrong all along. The world's initial phase took place in 7 days. I knew it all along. I read the Bible. Next year I won't take 5 weeks. Next year I'll take 666. I need time to plan Iran's invasion and to get my barbecue fixed.
Welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour. Truth and common sense in broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program. We heard the clip of George W. Bush before, essentially denying what he knew to be true from the National Intelligence Report. Here's Dick Cheney on Face the Nation with Tim Russert. Or is it Meet the Press? Meet the Press with Tim Russert.
Here's what the American people said in a recent poll. Is the U.S. involvement in Iraq or Afghanistan creating more terrorists or eliminating terrorists? And look at that. Overwhelmingly, 54%, clear majority, believe we are creating more terrorists. I can't buy that.
Dick Cheney, I can't buy that. And then, of course, afterwards he said,
you don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah. So now, at a certain level, I think that my engagement in that debate with David, and just the way this whole thing is being played out in the media, of who's more responsible for 9/11, Clinton or Bush, does the entire discourse of politics in the United States, particularly that has to do with, well, let's just leave it at that, does the entire discourse a disservice? And I want to cop to that at a certain level, because it becomes my team versus your team, who's good and who's bad, who's right and who's wrong. Okay. But there are larger stakes here. And that's why I think it's a discussion that is worth having and a point that is important to make. And the larger stake that is here is that, and I'm going to try and phrase this in a way that doesn't sound like I'm doing the, oh, my team is right, their team is wrong, even though it's probably going to come across this way. The larger stake, because I consider this to be simply a statement of fact, the larger stake that is here is the stake of Americans understanding their own history. Americans understanding what actually has happened, because, you know, to paraphrase, Churchill, and I think he was paraphrasing somebody else, you know, those who don't learn the lessons of history are doomed to repeat them. It's not a matter of was Clinton more responsible or was Bush more responsible. It's a matter of what's real. There is a campaign underway by people within the Bush administration and within the media, particularly Fox News, the Rupert Murdoch's media. There is a campaign underway to rewrite history. to change our perception of history, to change the reality of history, to change our understanding of history. And that campaign, frankly, in my opinion, is dangerous and destructive to democracy itself. Whether that history makes Bill Clinton look good or bad, I don't care, frankly. You know, I thought in many regards Bill Clinton was a very good president. In other regards, I thought he was a very bad president. Those of you who listen to the program regularly know I have some very serious disagreements with Bill Clinton. I think he sold the country out with NAFTA and GATT and the Telecommunications Act of 96. Those were crimes in my opinion. Now, it certainly had a lot of Republican enablers. They were the major force behind those things. But nonetheless, I don't think he should have done those. On the other hand, he did some good things as president. His environmental record was great. His fiscal record was great. He did some good things. But he tried to get bin Laden repeatedly. And the record is quite clear about this. The 9/11 Commission lays it right out, what they were doing. On a weekly basis, they were having these meetings. On a daily basis, they were out there trying to track this guy down and kill him. They were trying to stop him. They knew he was a threat. And George W. Bush came into office and said, bin Laden's what? I'm not so worried about that. We're not going to pay attention to that. In fact, Condi Rice, when her highest priorities when she came in were not only not bin Laden, her highest priorities were missile defense. I mean, this is, from Time magazine in 02, August 4th, 02. The terrorism briefing in the White House Situation Room on January 2001 was delivered by Richard Clark. Senior officials from both the Clinton and Bush administration say that Clark had a set of proposals to roll back al-Qaeda. In fact, the heading on slide 14 of the PowerPoint presentation reads, "Response to al-Qaeda, roll back." Okay, so, in other words, Clark did say, in fact, it goes on to say, Time magazine goes on to say, Clark's proposals called for the breakup of al-Qaeda cells and the arrest of their personnel. So how did George Bush respond? In a speech on May 1st, 2001, he said that the most urgent threat was ballistic missiles. I'm quoting George Bush now, May 1st, 2001, before 9/11. Unlike the Cold War, today's most urgent threat stems not from thousands of ballistic missiles in the Soviet hands, but from a small number of missiles in the hands of those states. States for whom terror and blackmail are a way of life. In other words, he was already ginning up a war against Saddam Hussein. The Washington Post, April 1st, 2004. After his first meeting with NATO heads of state in Brussels in June 2001, Bush outlined the top five defense issues discussed with his closest U.S. allies. Missile defense was at the top of the list. No reference to al-Qaeda whatsoever. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
My call ain't been crazy. It's kept me from going insane. Nobody knows if it's something to bless or to blame. Till now, I ain't found a rhyme or a reason to change.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Here we are. 34 minutes past the hour. I need to take your phone calls on this. But first I want to just... The point that I was making, and I just want to just nail this point with a quote from George Washington. And then we'll take your calls here. Part of the rewriting of history is not just, who's right, who's wrong. Is it more Bill Clinton? Is it more George? The latest poll, by the way, late Gallup poll, 53% of Americans, George W. Bush, is to blame for Osama bin Laden not being caught. But we have now George W. Bush rewriting the rules on torture and interrogation. We have George W. Bush rewriting the rules on habeas corpus, which literally means having, and doesn't literally, but means having access to the courts. The habeas corpus laws started in 1215 in that field in Runnymede near the River Thames
when King John was confronted by the feudal lords and forced to sign the Magna Carta. The habeas corpus laws say the fundamental human right is that the king or the government cannot put you in jail without charging you with a crime and giving you access to a court to prove yourself innocent. Or the government having an opportunity to prove yourself guilty, depending on whether you're under Napoleonic law or U.S. law. But that's the core, and Bush wants to blow that away. So here's our quote. This is actually from David Hackett Fisher, the author of Washington's Crossings, one of America's great historians. And it's the story of George Washington. Quote, and by the way, thanks to Amy for sharing this with me in email. Quote, Washington often reminded his men that they were an army of liberty and freedom, and that the rights of humanity for which they were fighting should extend even to our enemies. To an officer with 221 Hessian prisoners of war, now the Hessians were Germans who came over as mercenaries on behalf of the British, and they were some of the most feared of the soldiers in the Revolutionary War by the guys on our side, because they just, you know, no mercy, no enemies, kill everybody inside. And the Hessians were just monstrous, murderous, barbaric. I mean, they were referred to as barbarians. On the other hand, at the same time, they also knew how to march in formation really well. So, I mean, it's just, but they were the toughest soldiers out there, right? So, anyhow, to another officer with 221 Hessian prisoners of war, George Washington said, quote, treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. Because the British were torturing Americans. In fact, at least one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence died being tortured in British prisons. Another one's wife died just right after being released from a British prison as a consequence of that torture. So George Washington told his troops, we don't do that. As historian Edmund Morgan says, Washington had, quote, made the war itself an example of what the revolution meant, end quote, and thus what America meant. And George W. Bush is changing all that, and that's what so concerns me, frankly. Dale in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dale, thanks for calling.
Thanks so much, Tom, for your article in Common Dreams, which you should point out to people on this subject. It was very good.
Thank you.
Mostly I wanted to ask, how could the Democrats use the fact that in amongst all this legislation is a big get-out-of-jail-free card for Bush for war crimes?
I know. I don't understand why they're not talking about it and why none of the talk show hosts are talking about it. It's like there's an embargo on it. Sunday morning, I was listening to NPR, and they had on a constitutional scholar, and he said that this legislation is going to give George W. Bush a get-out-of-jail-free card. But he did not say it in those words. He used such turgid legalese that had I not been familiar with the legal concepts, I wouldn't have had a clue what the guy was talking about.
Well, there's got to be a way that we can echo this and get this out there. Are you on the talk shows at all?
No, I'm typically not. I don't solicit them. I'm not one of those guys who's got a full-time publicist and all that kind of junk, you know. No, I just try to do a good radio show and write as much as I can. But you're hearing this. You know people. I mean, all of our listeners, we all need to be just spreading the word. And it, like you said, the piece that I wrote in Common Dreams, there's another piece before that. If you go to tomhartman.com and just click articles on democracy, they're the top two articles. They're both about George W. Bush getting a get-out-of-jail-free card from the Republicans with this legislation. And it is wrong. I mean, these guys have turned, these Republicans, Warner, McCain, and Graham, among others, have turned their backs on the American Constitution, and the Democrats need to be saying, no, we are going to face the Constitution and salute it.
It's our oath of office.
It is their oath of office.
Yeah.
I absolutely agree. And it is treason to, if not to America, certainly to the principles on which America was founded. Dale, thank you very much for the call. Scott in Rochester Hills, Michigan. Hey, Scott.
Hey, at the top of the hour, you were talking about Clinton and what Clark had said and the plans that they had. What year did Clark officially name Al-Qaeda, approximately?
Al-Qaeda was known in 93. 1993, it wasn't known that Osama bin Laden had any relationship to it until 1996. Clark had been national security advisor since the Bush senior administration. Well, actually, even he worked for Reagan, I believe.
Right. So, well, your buddy was saying, the guy that you were talking to was saying, how he had 8 years to come up with a plan. Well, he really didn't. It didn't really manifest itself till 1993.
But it was really 1996 that they put Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda together as, you know, 1 and 1 equals 2. That was 1996.
Okay, so yeah, you really didn't have all that much. You know, all the information that came out and about counterterrorism came out through Clark during the Clinton administration.
Right.
It wasn't like Bush had developed any of his own in that 8 months.
No, in fact, during that 8 months, Clinton demoted Clark. Clark was meeting with Bush demoted Clark. Clark had been meeting with Clinton every single week. They had weekly cabinet level meetings in which Clark came in and talked about this information. You read about it in his book. As soon as Bush comes in, he says, "I don't want to hear about that stuff anymore. I want to talk about missile defense. We need a missile shield system. We need to give another $1 trillion to those guys Ronald Reagan was giving money to, those guys that brought us conservatives into office." I mean, that's what it all became about, and it's a terrible thing. And George Bush just sat back for 8 months. They had put Dick Cheney in charge of the counterterrorism task force. Dick Cheney had two jobs: counterterrorism task force and the energy task force. Energy task force, what their job was to help Arnold Schwarzenegger get elected governor in California by conspiring with Kenny Lee to rig the energy markets in California and bring that whole thing down. And they were very successful. In fact, that's why, in my opinion. That and prepare for the war in Iraq and sell off the oil fields, and that's why Dick Cheney went all the way to the Supreme Court to keep those minutes secret. And the counterterrorism task force, which never even met until September of 2001. Scott, thanks for the call. Well said. Michael in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Michael.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up, Michael?
Oh, hey, I enjoyed your dialogue with TiVo.
David Tebow, yeah.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is when they keep, it's like rewriting again here, like you were saying, it's like blame Clinton seems to be the thing right up to the election here coming. But it was in the...
Well, this is a high-stakes election coming.
Oh,
because
totally.
If the Democrats take control of either the House or the Senate, then there's very high probability that a number of Republicans, possibly even the president and vice president, could end up, if not impeached, in jail.
I mean, that would be great. But, you know, Clinton had that thing where he averted that 10 planes from being bombed there, what, 96 or 97?
Yep, and then in 2000, the millennial plot bombing. Yeah, he stopped a number of things.
He was in there, and like you said, he met with Clark, but Congress, they were like, thought that Clinton was overstating the threat. Even Hatch was saying that, you know, you're making like a mountain out of a molehill. Trent Lott wouldn't even put it on any agenda. It's like, they're, like you said, just totally rewriting history again.
Oh, yeah. Egregious to at the extreme. In fact, there's some here we are, some amazing quotes here. This is Congressman Jim Gibbons. Look at the movie Wag the Dog. I think this has all the elements of that movie. This is right after Clinton tried to assassinate Osama bin Laden by tossing a cruise missile into Afghanistan. Arlen Specter on CNN, he says, this is August 20th, 1998. He says, there's an obvious issue which will be raised internationally here about the response here as to whether there's any diversionary motive involved. That was Arlen Specter. Senator John Ashcroft of Missouri, Republican of Missouri. Were these forces sent at this time because he needed to divert our attention from his personal problems? Pete Sessions, Republican from Texas. I will tell you that the timing is very questionable. This was the day that Monica Lewinsky has gone back to the grand jury, evidently enraged. Certainly that information will be overshadowed now because of this military strike against trying to kill Osama bin Laden. I mean, the Republicans were totally flipped out, totally incensed. How dare Clinton try to take out Osama bin Laden? I mean, he's not the thing that we need to be worried about. He's not the thing that Congress needs to be having meetings about. He's not the thing we need to spend $75 million investigating. It's whether or not Bill Clinton had sex in the Oval Office. That's what's important. That's what we need to be investigating. Bring in Ken Starr. Bring in the investigators. We need to get to the bottom of this. This is what's really vital for America. That's where the Republicans were at in 1998. And they want us to forget that. They want us to think that... Well, I don't know what they want us to think they were doing in 98. I mean, because they controlled Congress. But they certainly don't want us to think that Bill Clinton was doing anything to stop terrorism, when in fact he was doing an awful lot. And they certainly don't want us to know what George Bush was not doing from the time he was appointed by the Supreme Court until 9/11. 45 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Program, the True People's Radio. We'll be right back.
fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My country, tis of thee. But debt is what you'll be if you stand in the way of Cheney's war machine.
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Man, where you been? We couldn't find you, so we just went the other way.
And welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio.
Yes, you can support this radio program by letting your local radio stations know you're listening and you appreciate it, and supporting this, your local sponsors. Give them a call, visit their place of business, buy their products, and our national sponsors as well. Sacred Grounds Coffee, for example, saving the planet one cup at a time. Their phone number, 1-800-425-2532. It's all fair trade. It's all organic. And it's a great company, sacredgroundscoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, one of the finest Macintosh dealers in the country. They have all things PC, all things iPod, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, or smalldog.com. Welcome back to our program, 1-866-440-8466. Joe in Paris, France. Hey, Joe, I assume you're listening on the web stream, unless we have a new affiliate know about.
How are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
I'm calling because I heard part of your interview with David Tebow, and it's always amazing to me how the right-wingers have got to politicize this question of national security. I saw the interview on the internet of on Fox News with Bill Clinton,
mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think, a couple of observations, is the fact that a lot of things I don't like about Bill Clinton, I think that speaks for a lot of us, but for once we had a Democrat who actually stood up and defended himself.
I know.
What
and
a
then,
pleasure.
And then Hillary
what a pleasure
did it yesterday.
That was.
And then Hillary
did it
yesterday. Is it going to be the Clinton family that gives a spine back to the Democratic Party? I mean, how ironic.
It would be amazing. But the thing about it is the right-wingers are calling this a meltdown. And here we had Clinton, who was absolutely perfectly logical. All of his arguments connected. He was vigorous and never once did he lose his cool. Don't ever let anybody call this a meltdown. This was a command performance, and I was really proud of him. And particularly when in the face of some of the complete illogic of people like David Tebow, who seemed to think that once George Bush was inaugurated, that the coal never happened, and that the bombings in East Africa, in the embassies there, never happened, and the First World Trade Center, that at this point, once he's inaugurated, then of course it's a clean slate, and you have to wait for a catastrophe, wait for another terrorist.
Well, see, the Republicans have to spin it that way, because that's the only way they can spin it that would cause Bush's failure to do anything for the first 9 months in office to make sense.
Precisely. But
and what's amazing and tragic, Joe, is that there are Americans who believe this.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
They can sell it.
That's true. But, you know, if somebody can actually see a couple of times this interview, there's no meltdown here.
Yeah.
And the one thing that the right-wingers can never bring themselves to mention, the two words that they can't put together are Richard Clark.
Yeah.
You notice how it never comes up.
Yep, well said, Joe.
Because it embarrasses them.
Thank you for the call and for pointing it out. Well said. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to us there in Paris, France.
A pleasure. Good work.
Thanks. Lee in Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Lee.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
I'm fine. What's up?
Yeah. It's kind of funny that you just wondered whether the Clinton family would be the ones that gave the Democratic Party its spine back, whereas, you know, today... the Democratic Party, I think it was a national committee, made it very clear that they will not organize in any kind of opposition to Bush's Detainee Act.
Which
includes, of course, the destruction of the habeas corpus. Also allows Bush to define enemy combatants any way that he wants to.
Including you and me.
Is rather basic attack on the American Constitution.
Yeah.
And the Democratic Party is saying, no, we will not oppose it because we don't want to be beaten on the issue of national security.
Right. They're afraid that that will be used against them in the 2008 presidential election. And it is a shame, and it's a sellout by the Democrats. They need to be, I thought for a few minutes that a few Republicans might actually stand up. You know, Lindsey Graham and John Warner and John McCain. Turns out they wussed out. Then I thought, okay, Harry Reid's going to stand up to this thing. Nobody is standing up to this thing right now. And it's a national shame. It's a national shame. Lee, thank you for the call. Kevin in Centerville, Texas. Hey, Kevin, what's on your mind today?
Well, I want to talk about this, the Cheney Act.
Okay.
And I'll preface it. I started in the military in 1970. I did four tours in Vietnam. I did one in Desert Storm, and I've done one in Iraq. I've got over 37 years in the military.
Thank you for your service, sir.
Well, that's between here and there. Now, during Vietnam, I agree with you 100%. We were actually fighting, although a guerrilla army, we were fighting a army that was organized with the purpose of defending their country.
Yeah. Kevin, I have to let you know, we just have a minute here before we're out of the show, so if you can tighten it up a little.
Okay. Now, this Detainee Act, I agree with him 100% for the mindset of the enemy we are facing. It's not that it's the right thing to do.
Well, here's the question, Kevin. If we know, and the CIA is the source of this, the CIA says the most effective form of interrogation is not torture. The most effective form of interrogation is to induce the Stockholm syndrome in the other person, to get them to sympathize with you. Now, that can take a little longer. If you need to use draconian methods against people, the UCMJ actually does allow that. You know, the ticking time bomb scenario that is allowed right now under law. We don't need to change our laws to do that. But this idea of routinely torturing people, the CIA says this doesn't work.
But the fact of the matter is, when you capture one of these individuals, information is power. And the information they have needs to be extracted rapidly.
But the information we've been getting from using torture is bad information.
Not necessarily.
Well,
having seen it firsthand, I know for a fact that the information they're getting is well worthwhile.
So would you want your kids to be subject to that same kind of interrogation?
They are.
All right.
My oldest son is in Iraq now. My youngest son is in Afghanistan.
Kevin, I wish them well. I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I wish them well. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome back to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. Today in his briefing with the press, Tony Snow challenged a reporter who said that the national intelligence estimate that was just released shows that we're not safer. Snow retorted, he says, look, we're not winning. Please show me.
Yes. You said, first of all, that Al-Qaeda has been degraded. Actually, the report said Al-Qaeda's leadership has been degraded, but that its ranks have increased. You also just...
But operational... Okay.
Go through here. You also said that you're talking about things the administration has done,
right,
and yet the estimate is taking this into account and coming up with the conclusion that the factors fueling the growth of the movement that they report outweigh the vulnerability of the movement. Right. We'll do so for some time.
Yeah.
That's not
where they're
taking.
No.
So she just nails him with, you know, Tony, you just lied to us a couple of times here, and it's not what the NIE says. And so Tony's like, blah, 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 and here's what he says.
No, it talks about jihadism. It doesn't draw judgments like that. You've read national intelligence
tests. I'm quoting verbatim.
I know, but it look for we're not winning. Please show me.
No,
the president says we're winning.
Yes. Okay. Well, the good folks over at thinkprogress.org, Amanda over at thinkprogress.org, actually went through the NIE and pulled out those places in the national intelligence estimate
where it says we're not winning. So, Tony Snow, here you go, since you asked the question. On page one, a large body of all source reporting. Now, by the way, all source reporting is a very important phrase because this is 16 different spy agencies, 22 intelligence agencies. And this is a consensus document, which means all of them have signed off on it. There is absolute agreement. Anything they disagree about doesn't go into the document. A large body of all source reporting indicates that activists identifying themselves as jihadists, although a small percentage of Muslims, are increasing in both number and geographic dispersion. Now, gee, if you're fighting a war, and which I think is a terrible metaphor for this in the first place, but let's just go with Bush's metaphor for a moment. If you're fighting a war and your enemy is getting larger and stronger, how can you say that you're winning? The NIE continues, if this trend continues, threats to U.S. interests at home and abroad will become more diverse, leading to increasing attacks worldwide. This doesn't sound like winning to me. We assess that the Iraq jihad is shaping a new generation of terrorist leaders and operatives. I don't, you know, maybe Tony Snow and George Bush think that winning means that you create a perpetual enemy so you can have a perpetual war, so you can do like George Orwell suggested in 1984 and have a perpetually repressive government because the nation's always at war. I mean, the height of Franklin Roosevelt's power, for example, was during World War II. Maybe that's what these guys are trying to recreate. I don't know. Here, back to the document. Page 2. The Iraq conflict has become the cause célèbre for jihadists, breeding a deep resentment of U.S. involvement in the Muslim world and cultivating supporters for the global jihadist movement. And on pages 3 and 4, anti-U.S. and anti-globalization sentiment is on the rise, fueling other radical ideologies. This could prompt some leftists, nationalists, or separatist groups to adopt terrorist methods to attack U.S. interests. In total, how can you possibly say that, we're winning the war? By the way, there's now, this is all the NIE from April, from before Zarqawi was killed. And in it, it says, by the way, if we kill Zarqawi, it's going to help tremendously. I'm paraphrasing. It says that it'll scatter and there'll be smaller cells and all this kind of stuff. Well, we killed Zarqawi and it hasn't helped. And so there's a new NIE out that apparently is even worse than this one for the Bush administration. And the Bush administration said, yeah, sure, we'll show you that after the elections. Congresswoman Jane Harman, number two member of the House Intelligence Committee. She's number two because she's a Democrat. No, she's a senior member, but she has no power because the Republicans control the House of Representatives and they don't let Democrats do anything. Jane Harman has sent a letter to Intelligence Director John Negroponte, good old Death Squad John, demanding that he complete the second NIE on Iraq quickly and release a declassified version before the elections in November. Right. Well, in response to that, White House advisor Fran Townsend said,
my understanding is the planned release date, given the work that must be done to have it comprehensive and complete, is January of 07.
Yeah. We ain't going to release no stinking document before the elections. That's the bottom line here. Now, here's a completely different perspective that I am growing very fond of. Robert Dreyfus, writing over at TomPaine.com, and the reprint I'm reading is at CommonDreams.org. It's called Beware the NIE. And his subhead, Careful Democrats, the notion that the Iraq war is creating more terrorists may be false. What Robert Dreyfus is suggesting, and I think that this is brilliant, and I think this guy has nailed it, is that while it is true that the war in Iraq has had, to quote Dreyfus, a catastrophic effect on American interests,
He says it's opened a festering wound at the heart of the Middle East, a vortex of violence that threatens to fragment the nation of Iraq and spill over Iraq's borders and all six of its neighbors, inflamed Arab and Muslim public opinion against the U.S., alienating our allies, all that stuff. But has it produced more terrorists? He says, I don't think so. Now, this is really an interesting perspective. He points out, he says, my own discussions with top former U.S. intelligence and counterterrorism officials do indeed reflect an understanding in the intelligence community that the war in Iraq has inflamed radicalism. Indeed, that has been widely understood for more than 3 years. But it is a long leap from anti-Americanism to terrorism. He says, Muslims and Arabs seized with hatred or disdain for the United States have many options besides forming a terrorist cell. They can vote for Hamas if they are in Palestine, and they've done that. They can vote for Hezbollah and join its militia in Lebanon, and they've done that. They can join the anti-U.S. Sunni insurgency in Iraq, and they've done that. They can oppose moderate pro-American regimes in Cairo, Amman, Riyadh, and Islamabad, and they've done that too. But if they are becoming terrorists, there's no evidence of that. He says if the war in Iraq is producing hundreds or thousands or millions of recruits to Osama bin Laden, well, where are they? He points out al-Qaeda's organization has been devastated. Since 9/11, there have been no incidents of terrorism within the United States, only a tiny handful in Western Europe. He says it's a mistake and a dangerous one to confuse anti-Americanism, which is on the rise all around the world, with terrorism. Even states that he writes, I'm quoting him now, Mr. Dreyfus, he says, even states that militantly oppose U.S. policy in the Middle East, such as Iran and Syria, have not used terrorist proxies against us. Violent insurgencies such as Hezbollah and Hamas, along with Islamist insurgencies in Pakistan, Kashmir, Chechnya, Algeria, and the Philippines, have not attacked us either. So why is it, he asks. This is Robert Dreyfus, a Virginia-based writer specializing in politics and national security, the author of The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. This guy is no slouch. Contributing editor to The Nation, writer for Mother Jones, he says, so why is it that we want to reduce all our enemies, opponents, and adversaries to the single category of terrorist? Why is it so convenient to demonize our opponents in that manner? The use of the word terrorist instantly dehumanizes the other side, making it into something devilish, insane, or maniacal. The Bush administration has perfected this technique to a fine art rather than joining in. The Democrats need to stop talking about terrorism at every turn and refuse to join the Republicans in their facile use of the demon word terrorism. It's time to change the subject. What an interesting concept, that we're not actually increasing terrorism in the world. We're increasing anti-Americanism. But there was very little terrorism to begin with. I mean, you had 19 guys with box cutters here in the United States. You had, you know, some homegrown terrorists in England who blew up a subway train. You had some guys in Spain. This is nothing compared to, you know what, 20 years of the IRA versus the British Empire. The high point, the highlight of the high times of ETA versus Spain, or the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany. I mean, there was some real terrorism. 16 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And I won't back down. Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. In a world that keeps on pushing me around, but I'll stand my ground.
And welcome back. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Tom Hartman with you 21 minutes past the hour. For those of you listening in the Los Angeles area, I'll be at Roman's Bookstore this weekend in Pasadena at 4 p.m. And I'll be at the Bodie Tree Bookstore on Melrose Avenue in Hollywood at 8 p.m. on Saturday, September 30th. Just a quick heads up. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, Richard, Seattle, Washington. Hey, Richard.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Every time the discussion of torture comes up, it just really makes my blood boil. The whole notion that torture as a tool is effective. And I just wanted to make a point, counterpoint, because of the presidential debate, so to speak, between him and Wallace. Before 9/11 or before Bush, we used to have people on the ground infiltrating the terrorist cells, infiltrating the people who were perpetrating the problem. We were gathering information because we were sympathetic and gained their sympathy. It was a relationship between the informant and the informed.
And we were the good guys. We
had
the high moral ground.
That's how we were able to infiltrate them. We showed them our character. Now, after Valerie Plame and outing CIA operatives and Brewster Jennings, they can't trust us anymore. Yeah. And we can't get information except by torture. The only way we can get and poor information at that, and spy satellites. We're removed from the situation. We're so desperate for information, they're willing to torture people to get it.
Yeah, and what it does is it subjects our troops, our people, to the possibility of the same, and it reduces the entire world to the level of barbarity.
But the question of what is more effective, the sympathetic moral high ground where you can go to somebody with potentially questionable background and gain their sympathy and get them to work on your side versus torturing somebody where you've like infected them with a cancer. They're going to be your enemy, and they're going to create enemies with everyone they touch and share their story with.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's the problem, Richard. You have, for example, the caller in the very end of the last hour. There are some folks who share the worldview, and I suspect it has to do with how they were raised.
Are you referring to the guy who had his family? He'd spent many years in service.
Right. Yeah.
His is a great story, and that's why I had to call. Is I sympathize with his boots on the ground. He's trying to save himself and his buddies.
No, I understand, but there are, and I think he reflects a particular worldview that I believe is wrong, but is also pervasive and is out there. And that is, if to translate it into the world of parents and children, for example, that if you just slap the kid around enough, he'll finally tell you what's going on, you know, where the party's going to be tonight, or who's been smoking pot or whatever. You know, if you just slap him around enough, you just beat him up enough. And that's essentially the message that Bush is putting out to the security agencies. And the professionals in the CIA are saying, no, you don't have to be, you know, a wuss to use techniques that are not physically violent. You can use techniques that are not psychologically violent, for that matter. You can use techniques that are very sophisticated and very subtle and get much more information. And any psychologist will tell you that.
Well,
any therapist will tell you that. You want to know what's going on in somebody's life. The way you don't get it by threatening them.
No. You build bridges. You don't burn them.
That's right. That's right. And I think that there are just some people who, probably because of the way they were raised, don't understand that. They've never had the experience of that. Their experience has always been that they got their way through violence, and so they assume that that's the only way to get your way.
Developing a relationship to resolve the problems, don't just, you know, stand there brutishly as a thug, intimidating people.
Yeah. Well said.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the call, Richard. I appreciate it. Mike in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I have a question and a comment, but
sure.
First, I just want to say that you are truly an inspiration to me and all your listeners, so keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Mike.
My comment is just that I really feel like I'm living in bizarro world. That
you mean the old Superman thing where everything is exactly the opposite of the real world?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Republicans demonize Bill Clinton and treat him like he's a scoundrel. He was the president of the United States, and they act like he could care less about any of our security.
Well, remember, I mean, here you talk about being in a bizarre world.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
It doesn't get much more bizarre than that.
But, I mean, the worst part is it does. Like, Dick Cheney sat there a couple weeks ago and said that he hadn't looked at the Senate intelligence report about the intelligence going into Iraq.
Right.
Well, that's not an acceptable excuse. He's the vice president, and he had a major role in going into Iraq. It's his responsibility to read that report.
Well, he's not just the vice president. He's also the president of the Senate.
Right.
I mean, he's the bridge between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And you would think that if he's playing a policy-making role, that he'd want to know what the Senate Intelligence Committee, his own Republican colleagues, had to say. I don't believe that he was telling the truth, frankly. I think when he went on that show that Sunday, I think it was the Meet the Press, and said, well, I don't know, I haven't read the report, I think he was lying. I just don't believe he's that incompetent.
Exactly. I completely agree, but even still, that's not an acceptable answer. You can't just say, oh, I didn't read it, so I didn't know.
Well, tragically, Mike, it is an acceptable answer to the corporate media in the United States, to these guys who want to maintain, you know, they want to hang on to their $500,000-a-year jobs as TV stars, basically, rather than as real journalists. And it's an acceptable answer to their puppet masters at the big defense industry. Anyhow, Mike, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Big Boss Man, can't you hear me when I call? Big Boss Man, can't you hear me when I call? Can't you hear me when I call? Well, you ain't so big, you know you just call, that's all.
And welcome back. Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Condoleezza Rice.
The president was aware that there were issues inside the United States. He talked to people about this. But I don't remember the Al-Qaeda cells as being something that we were told we needed to do something about.
Isn't it a fact, Dr. Rice, that the August 6th PDB warned against possible attacks in this country? And I ask you whether you recall the title of that PDB.
I believe the title was Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States.
Oops. And notice she starts out saying, we weren't told we had to worry about Al-Qaeda cells. Now, the period she's recalling is August, a month before 9/11. From January of 2001, when the Supreme Court appointed George Bush as President of the United States, until August, they did nothing about Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Nothing. Bill Clinton had handed off this whole thing. Richard Clark had a whole program. And they said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to worry about ballistic missiles. And Rice, recalling that time, says, I don't think we were even told we had to worry about it. Well,
the president was aware that there were issues inside the United States. He talked to people about this. But I don't remember the Al-Qaeda cells as being something that we were told we needed to do something about.
Isn't it a...
I don't recall being told... I'm sorry, Sandy Berger sat with me and a small group of other reporters in a room in Washington, D.C. about a year and a half ago and said, I sat down with Condoleezza Rice because he was the national security advisor outgoing from the Clinton administration. She was the national security advisor incoming with the new Bush administration. He says, I sat down with her and told her, your number one priority is going to be Al-Qaeda because they're coming to get us. But the Bushies were like, anything Clinton did, we're not going to do. It was like a mantra for them. And all the more the tragedy for the United States. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. I was just wondering, why isn't there a big outcry or a calling campaign in liberal radio to stop this legislation for torture? I mean, we did all that with Alito.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems like they're changing a law now.
There is here on this program, Logan. I mean, every single day I tell people to call their senators and their members of Congress at 866-808-0065, toll free, 866-808-0065, and say, no, do not vote for, in fact, filibuster if you're in the Senate, that piece of legislation that's going to give George a get-out-of-jail-free card and going to allow torture.
Well, Democrats think they're learning from Max Cleland's situation by not opposing this torture law. They think they're going to, you know, be tarred with being weak on terror. But the thing is Max Cleland probably won that race.
That's right. And the pre-election polls showed him 5 points ahead. The post-election polls showed him 7 points ahead. And the draft-dodging, the Republican, Saxby Chambliss, who the electronic voting machines with no paper trail said won the election by 4 or 5 points, at no point before or after the race did any of the polls, including the exit polls, show that Saxby Chambliss actually won that race. You're absolutely right. I am convinced that that race was stolen in Georgia. In fact, Bev Harris, when she hacked the Diebold site, even found a folder on the Diebold website called Rob Georgia.
Yeah, well, I mean, so the idea that Max Cleland lost is just false. So the idea that the strategy of opposing the foreign policy is a loser is also false.
Yep.
Anyway, thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks, Logan. You need to be calling other talk shows as well, because this one, I have not only am I emphatic about that on this program, but the last two pieces over the last 2 weeks that I've written for commondreams.org, and that we have emailed out to all of the folks, the tens of thousands of people on our email list, and have been posted all over the internet, have all said this legislation essentially would be a get out of jail free card for George W. Bush on three different things: on violating habeas corpus. In other words, on throwing people in jail without charging them with crimes, which under this new legislation he will be able to do, even with you or me, throw you in jail for the rest of your life and never even tell you what the crime is you've been charged with, number one. Number two, torture you. And number three, wiretap people without getting a court order. I mean, this is anti-American. This is not just illegal. This is anti-American. This flies in the face of the principles on which this country was founded. Literally the principles on which this country was founded. Read the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th Amendments of the Constitution. These are the bedrock principles on which this country was founded. Merrill Lee in Everett, Washington. Hey, welcome to the program. What's up? Merrill Lee?
Everett. Oh, hello. This is Merrill Lee.
Hi, Merrill
Lee. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine.
Yes, concerning this torture bill, if it became law, would those young men and that woman who were called the bad apples and sent to prison for torturing then be given out of jail card as well?
Probably not, because they're subject to justice not under the normal U.S. court system, but under what's called the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. They could still be prosecuted. What it provides a get out of jail pass for is the people who are actually doing the torturing, which is the contractors for the big defense contracting companies. And
okay.
if you haven't seen Robert Greenwald's movie Iraq for Sale, you need to find a copy of it and see it, because it's real. That's what it's all about.
And okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you. About what you just said about the various amendments, wouldn't that make members of Congress who do not filibuster and vote this down committing treason?
In my opinion, yes. In my opinion, those members of Congress who vote in favor of this legislation are, at the very least, traitors to the principle of this country. I'm reluctant to call them traitors to the United States. I think it requires just a little bit more than that. But they're certainly traitors to the principles of this country, absolutely. Merrill Lee, thanks for the call. This is just a grim one. David in Granby, Massachusetts. Hey, David.
Hi, it's good to talk to you.
Thank you.
I've heard you in the past talk about how the first George Bush refers to Portland as Little Beirut.
Yeah.
If that's true, I think we can safely refer to Crawford as Little Berchtesgaden.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, Berchtesgaden. That was where the crow's nest or the eagle's nest was, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
That little piece you played of Condi Rice, I think, was just so instructive. And I'm sure you must have noticed the difference between the way Fox News handled Bill Clinton's interview and Katie Couric handled Condoleezza Rice's interview on 60 Minutes.
Yep.
I mean,
yeah,
John
Stewart pointed that out.
I mean, my God, you know, it was like Katie Couric did everything but offer to shine her shoes and detail her car for her.
Yeah.
But I wish the other clip that I think needs to be played is how Condi had no idea that nobody could imagine that people would hijack airliners and fly them into buildings.
Yeah.
I mean, even though when Bush went to the G8 summit in Genoa that summer, the Italians were so concerned about just that scenario happening that they put anti-aircraft batteries all around the meeting site.
Well, not only that, George W. Bush and Condi Rice slept on an aircraft carrier instead of the hotel in which they were scheduled to sleep, specifically for that reason, because they were concerned that they had specific intelligence that Al-Qaeda, that Osama bin Laden was going to hijack a plane and crash it into a building.
So it's just like every time I hear these guys, and that I'm sorry that includes your friend David Thiebaud. You know, I mean, I'm sure he's a nice guy and everything, and I wish him well in his health problems, but I mean, their arguments are just so cheap and dishonest that I feel like I have to fact-check them every time I listen to them speak. And
yeah,
I just don't have the energy for that anymore.
Well, and increasingly, I want to have the discussions be more on our discussions with David and all these other conservatives, and I try as often as possible to take it to these things on what are the real philosophical differences that are driving this thing, rather than just, you know, hey, I'm right, you're wrong kind of thing. I mean, and I think that it's important that the real story get out there. On the other hand, I think it's also important that our listeners have the tools to win the water cooler wars. You know, in other words, understand how to debate these folks, because we have them in our lives, we have them in our families, we have them in our places of work, we have them in our places of worship, whatever it may be.
Yeah, well, I just want to say I can't thank you enough for what you're doing on the radio, and just keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate it. Very kind of you, David.
Take care.
Appreciate it. 1-866-440-8466. John in Mount Vernon, Washington. Hey, John.
Hey, Tom. I think I just figured it out, who the 40% that still support the president are.
Right.
I think we can directly compare them to the people every single one of us have known, whether it be a brother or another relative or a best friend, that was in love with someone who, no matter whether they were having sex with 10 other people and were axe murderers or whatever, it didn't matter what you told them.
Oh, yeah.
They were in love.
Yeah,
were in love.
That's a universal human condition, isn't it? We've all had friends who've made, and we probably all of us have made stupid decisions at times, too.
Yeah,
we've
absolutely.
Had friends say it to us, you know. Hey, wait a minute.
There.
Look out
I've
for
been
her.
There.
Yeah, I've been
there, and that's why with those 40%, it's basically useless.
Yeah,
argument.
Love is blind. Good point, John.
Yeah. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Oh, and on the way out here, Condi Rice.
How do you answer administration critics who say that the administration's actions have helped unleash the very hostilities you hope to contain?
Well, first of all, those hostilities were not very well contained, as we found out on September 11th.
Yeah.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I believe in love and I live my life according to you. But I choose to let the mystery be.
Welcome back. Viagra for your brain. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Don't tell Limbaugh, though. He'll want some. And it does not lead to stiff thinking. 9 minutes before the hour. Poor David, he's fallen over here. David Poole, my producer. Okay, I won't use that one for a while. 1-866-440-8466 is our telephone number. Hillary comes out and defends her man. And here you have Bill Clinton going on the offensive. Now Hillary, then Condi Rice comes back and says, "Oh, no, it's not true. It's not true. No specifics, but it's not true." Today, the Clintons fighting back again.
My husband did a great job in demonstrating that Democrats are not going to take these attacks. You know, all you have to do is read the 9/11 Commission to know what he and his administration did to protect Americans and prevent terrorist attacks against our country. You know, and I'm certain that if my husband and his national security team had been shown a classified report entitled "Bin Laden Determined to Attack Inside the United States," he would have taken it more seriously than history suggests it was taken by our current president and his national security team.
Now, you know, Hillary Clinton certainly is not my candidate for president of the United States, although I would support her and vote for her if she was the Democratic Party's nominee, but not at the top of my list. I know she's not at the top of your list either, Ellen Ratner of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. But could it be that Hillary and Bill Clinton are going to give back the Democratic Party their spine?
I'm hoping, and actually the person that I'm hoping is going to give back their spine is Senator Levin. As we speak, I am up at the Senate, and Senate Bill 3930, the Military Commissions Bill, is what is pending. And, of course, this has been discussed essentially in conference, and it has not come back in the way that things were essentially agreed upon.
Is this the so-called compromise bill?
This is the so-called compromise bill. Well, Senator Levin just got up, and you should have listened to him. I mean, he went through it blow by blow. This bill is so bad that they can take a green card citizen, or not citizen, because they're not citizens, but a green card resident of the United States, and they can declare them an enemy combatant in the United States, and that's the end of their habeas corpus or ability to get any release in the courts.
They can at that point put them in prison for the rest of their lives without ever charging them with a crime.
A legal resident of the United States of America. They can declare an enemy combatant. Now,
can they declare a citizen an enemy combatant?
No, they can't declare a citizen, but they can, you know, there's lots of people who keep Canadian citizenship.
Sure.
or English citizen. I mean, you know, and they can say about that person, Adam Sharon, who used to work for us, he's a Canadian citizen, he's married to an American. They can say, Adam, you're an enemy combatant. They can seize evidence without a warrant on those enemy combatants and use those as they will.
Now, here's where it gets bizarre, Ellen Ratner, with TalkRadioNews.com, the Talk Radio News Service, this is sort of an analog to the terror, to the torture thing. The standard that we have historically used, and George Washington, by the way, set this standard when he told an officer who was holding 221 Hessian prisoners of war during the Revolutionary War, he said, treat them with humanity and let them have no reason to complain that we are copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. In other words, we are, well, as historian Edmund Morgan said, Washington, George Washington, made the war itself an example of what the American Revolution meant. By saying historically, we will treat our prisoners of war the way we would want our soldiers treated if they were held as prisoners of war by somebody else. We are not opposed to interrogation. We are opposed to torture. By changing that, I mean, aren't we also setting up a situation now where if you or I get on a plane and go over to Germany or England or any other country in the world and they say, oh, it's an enemy combatant, and lock us up for the rest of our lives without charging us with a crime, where our government will not be able to protest because we're doing that to their people?
That's right. And the problem is the Democrats, who we're hoping they get some spine, are not, it looks like, going to filibuster the bill.
Oh, my God. And so, people, this is Senate Bill
3930.
And people need to call their senator, 866-808-0065, toll free, 866-808-0065, or direct the direct number 202-225-3121. Both those numbers get you to the Capitol Hill switchboard. Ask for your senator, whatever state you happen to be in, you have two of them, call both of them and say, filibuster Senate Bill 3930. If you're a Democrat and if you're a Republican, do not vote for that thing, because this is...
Well, they could filibuster it, too.
Well, they could. Yeah, they could. They absolutely could. This is the end of Americanism in America.
It is,
I mean,
staggering.
This is the end of our traditional, the values that George Washington fought for.
That we all live for.
Yeah, it's just absolutely mind-boggling. Ellen Ratner is with us, TalkRadioNews.com. We have about a half a minute. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington, you're live with Ellen and me. You wanted to make a point on this stuff?
Yeah, I just got a letter to the editor printed in the Tacoma News Tribune, and I'd like to encourage everybody to do the same. There are many different ways we can use our democracy to protect our democracy, and I think everybody really needs to get on the ball, call all their friends, give them that number.
Yeah. And
to make this happen, because we're all in danger.
Yeah, good point, Jeff. I'm assuming you agree, Ellen.
Yes.
Write letters to the editor. Call 866-808-0065 or 202-225-3121. Get out there, get active, get the message out, and say no to Senate Bill 3930. No to the what's the name of it, Ellen?
It is the Military Commissions Bill.
The Military Commissions Bill. Thank you very much, Ellen.
You're
Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. TalkRadioNews.com. Right now, time for the Tom Hartman Program's Progressive Pop Quiz. Today's question is, the Bush administration says the new NIE will not be declassified until when? The sixth caller with the correct answer at 866-440-THOM, 440-8466 gets an autographed copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. The answer coming up after the news at the top of the hour. The Bush administration says the new national intelligence estimate won't be declassified until when?
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, the place where smart people get their news. We have a winner in our progressive pop quiz, by the way. Our question, once again, was the Bush administration says the new national intelligence estimate, the one that just came out, will not be declassified until when? And congratulations to Joe Delso in Sacramento, California, listening on KSAC. Joe knew that the correct answer is not until after the November elections, or quite specifically, now we have old Fran Townsend over there at the White House saying, well, it won't be until January, actually. So either answer was just fine because that's, you know, the bottom line there. And congratulations, Joe. Joe wins a copy of my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It.
Get Screwed by Tom Hartman.
That's right. There's the ad. Larry Johnson is with us. He's an ex-intelligence officer with the Central Intelligence Agency and the State Department's Office of Counterterrorism. His website, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Great. Great to have you back on with us.
Good to be with you.
Two things that I wanted to talk to you about. The first is, of course, what's in the news, this national intelligence estimate that Bush declassified yesterday. It was written back in April. First of all, what's your take on it?
Well, I had lunch yesterday with an old friend of mine who has just left the CIA, or in the process of leaving, and he said he wasn't quite sure what all the fuss was about because this had been common knowledge for 3 years.
Yes.
In other words, that, you know, this war in Iraq was spawning more terrorism within CIA. They've been saying this for 3 years.
Yeah.
So
well, it's not exactly rocket science. You would.
No.
I mean, I'm just astounded that Bush is able to continue to insist this, and that Americans buy it. I mean, I just don't get it.
Well, I've written on this. In fact, last year I made the point, and when you looked at the statistics which were issued by State Department from the CIA on terrorism, that it had reached an all-time high in terms of what they call significant attacks, attacks in which someone's killed or wounded.
Right.
That had gone from 175 in 2003 to 651. Now, when you look at this, going back to data in 1968, we've never, ever had a number that high.
Right.
And so this is just unprecedented to have this amount of terrorism, which people are being killed and wounded, and the number of countries that it was occurring in. And that was all a direct consequence of going into Iraq. In fact, over 30% of the attacks in 2004 were caused, directly related to what was happening in Iraq.
And yet, Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com, and yet, Larry, 1 week ago today, before this NIE had become public, George W. Bush, in a petulant answer. I mean, I don't understand how the cons can say that Bill Clinton was berserk and out of control on Fox when
yeah.
when Bush responds the way he does in this response. George W. Bush goes nuts when a reporter asks him essentially the same question: Haven't your policies in Iraq made us less safe? And he goes off and just, you know, just bang off he goes and says, you know, no, it's we're a whole lot safer and just, you know, into full rant mode. I don't know how to characterize it other than that. I actually thought I had the clip here. Hang on just a second. I think I can play it. Yeah, it's the wrong machine. No, it's not playing. Oh well. Anyhow, you know.
No, I remember it. And you're right that it is. You know, these guys.
No, I've heard this theory about, you know, everything was just fine until we arrived, and you know, kind of
stir up the hornet's nest theory. It just doesn't hold water as far as I'm concerned. The terrorists attacked us and killed 3,000 of our citizens before we started the freedom agenda in the Middle East.
The freedom agenda?
Yeah, freedom. I mean, you know, this is why George Orwell wrote his books, Animal Farm, and 1984, because you can take language and try to convince people that it is just, you know, that black is white and up is down. You know, I guess Lewis Carroll started it with Alice in Wonderland, but, you know, honest to God, I have never seen adults so divorced from reality in all of my time being associated with government in one capacity or another. This is scary to believe, to understand and realize that how out of touch that these folks are. In fact, just today we hear that the attacks in Iraq have gone up more, you know, they've dramatically increased in the last 2 weeks. Nobody's putting into the context that in July and August, those were the highest months ever since we've been in Iraq for attacks.
Right. Now, let me put a slightly different frame around this thing, Larry Johnson, and get your take on it. We're talking with Larry Johnson, former CIA agent, officer, noquarter.typepad.com, his blog. If we were to consider that the guys attacking our people and attacking others in Iraq should not correctly and accurately be called terrorists, but might more appropriately be called insurgents, that
right.
is to say they're people who are saying, get the hell out of here, this is our country. They're behaving in a way that we might behave if Mexico and Canada were to occupy the United States. And just take the word terrorism out of the Iraq equation.
Sure.
Then if you look around the world, in the last 15 years or so, since the IRA stopped their bombing campaign in England and ETA came to a truce with Spain and the Baader-Meinhof gang was put out of business 20 years ago in Germany and the Red Brigades were put out of business in Italy 25 years ago. Since that time, essentially, there have been, six really serious terrorist attacks around the world, maybe a handful, a dozen?
No, there have actually been quite a few more. What's really odd, you're correct in noting that you go back to the 1980s and even into the 1990s, the threat of terrorism was from a variety of groups. It was not concentrated in any one sector.
Well, no, the larger point that I'm trying to make is that are we wildly overstating, or is the Bush administration wildly overstating for political advantage, the threat of terrorism, period?
Yeah, yes. I mean, look, terrorism's a threat. It has gotten worse, and the primary responsibility for making it worse in terms of attacks, larger mass casualty attacks, an increase in the number of attacks. But nonetheless, when you put it in a broader context, it's still not nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. It is
right.
a threat that we must deal with, but to mobilize society as if this is the greatest threat we've ever faced, I agree with you, is just nonsense. So, I mean, there's got to be a common sense approach to it. We need to recognize that there has been a dramatic increase among Islamic extremists, and the emphasis is on extremists, who have stepped up violence against other Muslims and against the West.
But I mean, if we look at the United States, for example, the two biggest attacks that we had in the United States were both done by religious extremists.
Yeah.
One was the Muslim extremist who took down the World Trade Center. The other was the Christian extremist, Tim McVeigh, who took down Oklahoma City.
Right. Right.
And so really religious fundamentalism, not Islamic fundamentalism, but religious fundamentalism, Christian and Muslim fundamentalism, have been responsible for the two largest losses of life in the United States in the last decade.
Yeah, I've been on this language issue. I prefer extremism because there are a number of fundamentalists that I've run into, both Muslim and Christian and Jewish.
Who are proud of their fundamentalism.
They're proud of it. They're practitioners and they're nonviolent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they take, you know, like the Christian fundamentalists take that notion of Jesus saying, you know, love your enemy and do good to those that abuse
you. Okay, point taken. Yeah, good point taken. So then, and in fact, there are some people who claim the mantle of fundamentalism, like Pat Robertson, who is not a Christian fundamentalist. Real Christian fundamentalists do not call for the assassination of other people.
Well, no, that's exactly right. And I think that's why I think this religious extremism that we're seeing, where, you know, we find folks in our country as well willing to go out and do just god-awful, horrible things to other folks, and then they're all willing to do it in the name of religion, or at least justify it in religion, or they look for, you know, the last days, the second coming of Jesus is an opportunity to fill some valley over in Israel with blood. And it's like, you know, come on, folks.
Yeah.
We need some rational adult leadership here.
So how do we go about, we're talking with Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, how do we go about ramping down the hysteria and getting Americans back to the, to the notion that, 50,000 people die of car accidents, 25,000 of them from drunk drivers every year, 400,000 people in America die from tobacco. I mean, there's some real dangers out there. Let's put these things in context.
Well, I put a chart up on my website a couple of weeks ago that was based upon the Homeland Security color code chart.
Mm-hmm.
But at the top, the red was the 240,000 people that have died in automobile accidents in the last 11 years. Compared to the 3,600 that have died from international terrorism, which when you looked at all the other threats that kill people, international terrorism was in the green zone.
Yeah, well, more people die from lightning strikes every year.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, it is a threat. And
you're more likely to drown in your bathtub.
And that's why we need to
maybe we should warn people about bathtubs.
Well, people need to be educated about this, and they need to, recognize that there are some folks out there who would like to do us harm, but they're not everywhere, and they can't sustain operations, and we can go out and deal
with
them.
Is it possible that their numbers are actually diminishing?
In some aspect, yes. So far, yes. But I think we run the risk that if we continue to oppress Muslims, that we can ignite a Muslim holy war. That's what I fear.
And that's definitely not a good thing.
Not a bad thing.
There you go. Larry Johnson, noquarter.typepad.com. Larry, thanks for sharing your wisdom with us.
Hey, thank you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where smart people get their news.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Well, speaking of bringing it down, the Bush administration bringing down a lot of veterans these days. Welcome back, by the way, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. Larry Scott on the line with us with VAWatchdog.org, the nation's premier site for veterans to figure out what's going on with the Veterans Administration. Not just veterans, anybody who's concerned about veterans issues, anybody who has a veteran in their family or a friend, or anybody who's frankly a patriotic American and concerned about the future of our nation and the people who defend it at arms. Hey, Larry.
That covers everybody.
There you go. That was my goal.
Hi again, Tom.
Good to have you with us. Agent Orange study findings called flawed. Two scientists involved in a 25-year, $140 million ranch hand study say it may underestimate cancer risk for Vietnam veterans. Ranch hand?
Ranch hand is what was the study that the Air Force has been doing for about 25 years. What they've been doing is studying veterans, mainly Air Force personnel, who were directly involved in the spraying of Agent Orange and other dioxin-laced herbicides in Vietnam and surrounding areas. What we've found now, the study's coming to an end. It ends with the fiscal year just a few days from now on September 30th. And there has been a whole big brouhaha the last couple of weeks about the final report here on ranch hand. The Air Force is refusing to include some information in the study from these scientists because it shows an increased incidence of cancer in people who were exposed to Agent Orange. And these two scientists are pretty upset about this because what they found was that the Air Force was using a flawed way of conducting the study. And basically they were taking their test group, which was Air Force personnel who directly handled Agent Orange, and then their control group. You think their control group would be people who weren't in Vietnam.
Who had nothing to do with Agent Orange.
Right. Well, their control group was other veterans who were in Vietnam and were exposed to Agent Orange.
Oh, geez.
In one way or another. So
the guys on the ground who are having the stuff sprayed on their head are being compared to the guys in the air who are spraying it.
Right.
Let's see who had more cancer.
So what you've got is you've got two groups with pretty close rates of cancer, and the Air Force is saying, well, it's obvious here that there's no increased risk in cancer with the people who handled the Agent Orange. when really you've got a flawed study from top to bottom here. And so what we have to do is really take a longer look at this, and because we know there is a direct link between Agent Orange exposure and cancer. And the
we had during those years, Larry, we had soldiers stationed in Germany, we had soldiers stationed in Japan, we had soldiers stationed in Guam, we had soldiers stationed here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Certainly as many as the 500,000 people who cycled through Vietnam during the time that that war happened. Why, if they want to compare soldiers to soldiers, so at least they're getting people who had the same required vaccine regimens and the same, you know, and basically were eating the same food or whatever, I mean, you know, and were the same age and went through the same physicals and have the same kind of physical history and age profile and all that kind of stuff, why didn't they compare Vietnam vets with non-Vietnam vets?
I can't answer that.
I mean,
I honestly don't have an answer for that, Tom. That is so logical that it just doesn't fit into the government's way of conducting studies like this.
Well, then it sounds to me, Larry, like what you're saying without saying it is that this study was rigged from the get-go to produce the result that Dow Chemical has no liability here, and neither does the U.S. Army.
You would have to say that, and I can name a couple of million veterans who cycled through Vietnam who would say exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
That basically this is just the government's way of putting a lid on it and saying, hey, don't worry about it. And that is absolutely a crying shame, because we know a lot of damage was done to a lot of people and to their children.
And this study is going to be coming out when?
The study will come out sometime next year, the final version of it.
And there's nothing that vets can do about this? There's nothing.
What we'll do is keep pushing for more studies, more long-range studies, because we're just finding the problems with Agent Orange, we believe, are just coming to the surface. We feel that there's long-term genetic damage that can be handed down from generation to generation. And you and I have talked about this before. The Agent Orange crisis of what it does to the human body will be with us for many, many generations to come. It's just the tip of the iceberg, Tom.
Yeah. Amazing. Along those same lines, I'm just curious if there's, with depleted uranium, which is going to be the Agent Orange of the Gulf War and the Iraq War, if there's similar nonsense being played?
It's being pretty much ignored. When veterans come back from, a tour of duty, they can check in and be tested for depleted uranium. But we found that within a few weeks, actually, Dr. Doug Rocky, who is an expert on this, will tell you within 3 months of exposure to depleted uranium, there's really no way to tell if you've been exposed other than possible genetic damage. But the government isn't interested in testing for genetic damage.
Is that because your body flushes it or your body stores it?
No, your body will flush it, the various isotopes, over a period of time. So if you're exposed to depleted uranium within a few days, if they do a urinalysis, they'll be able to say, yes, you were exposed. But within 90 days, there is no way to tell from a urinalysis if you were ever exposed. Dr. Rocky and others who have studied this carefully over the last, since the first Gulf War, since 1991, will tell you that the real danger is in the long-term damage and the genetic damage it does to the body.
Right. During the 90 days that stuff was in your body, it was emitting all kinds of radiation and busting up DNA all over your body.
Exactly right.
Yeah, amazing. Larry Scott, VAWatchdog.org, the website. Check it out. Larry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
But that's not the world I live in. It's not the life for me. My world's bigger than your problem, and it's bigger than me. That's not the world I live in. It's not the life for me. My world's bigger than your problems, and it's bigger than me.
Welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least a clean election, you know? I mean, we would settle for a clean election because, you know, the thing is, we'd win. Every single time. In fact, I have a story to share with you. Today's Wall Street Journal, and a little history that just brings that so to the front. But first, let's see what's going on with the U.S. occupation of Iraq.
I want to know the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are. But they're never the ones to fight and to die. And there are lies in the balance. There are people on the fire.
Following our security and other developments in Iraq, reported on Wednesday as of 14:30 Greenwich Mean Time from Reuters, Baqaba, U.S. raid and airstrike killed 8 people, including 7 members of one family, wounded 2 others in that city. The U.S. said the 4 men in the family of 7 were suspected of having links to al-Qaeda. In Baghdad, a car bomb exploded near a busy market in the mostly Shiite district of Ba'a in southwestern Baghdad, killing 5 people and wounding 8 others. In Baghdad, gunmen in a Sunni mosque fired on a police checkpoint on Tuesday in the Qadara district, western Baghdad, Iraq's Armed Forces Command said in a statement. When police commando returned fire, they killed 2 and wounded 2 others and freed 2 people being held captive in the mosque. Police commandos killed 7 militants and wounded 3 Tuesday inside a Sunni mosque in the Amil district of southwestern Baghdad. In Baqaba, a police patrol transferring detainees was struck by a roadside bomb, killing 4 people, including 2 of the detainees, and wounding 2 policemen. In Rashad, mortar rounds landed on and around an Iraqi army checkpoint in that small town, killing 2 soldiers and wounding 3 others. In Mosul, an insurgent was killed when clashes erupted between insurgents and the Iraqi army in the western part of Mosul. 3 insurgents were detained after the clash. In Baghdad, 2 roadside bombs exploded in quick succession in Qarara district, south-central Baghdad, killing 1 passerby and wounding 3 others. In Kirkuk, at least 10 people were wounded when a car bomb exploded near the headquarters of the Turkmen Front Party in central Kirkuk. In Musayab, a roadside bomb targeting a police patrol exploded, wounding 3 policemen. In Baghdad, Nima al-Yassin, the sister of Shiite Member of Parliament Lika al-Yassin, was shot dead on Tuesday as she headed to work in western Baghdad. In Anbar province, a U.S. Marine and a soldier died on Monday in separate combat incidents in that western province. And in other developments, as part of its national reconciliation plan, the Iraqi government said in a statement it had released 120 prisoners for the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. And in Baghdad, Sunni tribal leaders from the Anbar province met Shiite Prime Minister Nuri al-Maliki and pledged to work with the government to fight al-Qaeda, an organization that didn't exist inside Iraq before we invaded. Gee, what a surprise. Okay, here's the story from the Wall Street Journal that I wanted to share with you. I think this is really interesting. I find this fascinating. First of all, a little background. Back in 1976, what would that be, 30 years ago? 70, 80, 90, 100, yeah, 30 years ago to the year. A guy by the name of Jude Walensky, came up with what he called the two Santa Claus theory. The problem was that from the 1880s, more or less, when the Republican Party became the party of the anti-federalist government party, basically. In fact, let me back up a little bit more. The Civil War brought about a profound change in the nature of the U.S. government. Before the Civil War, we had a federalist system where the federal government was weak and the states were strong. That led to southern states saying, we're going to make our own rules. And when Lincoln declared the Emancipation Proclamation, the southern states said, no, doesn't apply to us. We're separate. Now, that's obvious, you know, this is a back-of-the-envelope, lousy history of the Civil War. But this, and that's not what triggered the whole Civil War thing. In fact, Lincoln did the Emancipation Proclamation after the Civil War had already started. But in essence, you know, that's what was going on. And so after the Civil War, Lincoln fundamentally changed, not even Lincoln really, I mean, the whole political structure of the United States changed throughout and after the Civil War, so that the federal government became strong and the states became weak. And ever since then, the Republican Party has been the party of let's go back to before the Civil War, to a weak federal government and strong states. Thus, the whole states' rights argument. Thus, the Barry Goldwater defending segregation because saying hey, this is none of the federal government's business. You know, all that kind of stuff. Okay. And one of the cornerstones of this has been that the federal government has gotten too big and too powerful with things like supporting public education, shouldn't be doing that, whether it's in high schools or college. Welfare programs shouldn't be a social safety net. Social security shouldn't be doing that. That's not the role of the federal government. Unemployment insurance shouldn't be doing that, shouldn't be assisting the states, helping the states build roads. I mean, you know, you name it. The federal programs right across the board, that the federal home loan mortgage, you know, mortgage insurance for home loans, the GI Bill, I mean, all of these things have been opposed by Republicans. So the Republican mantra since Reconstruction after the Civil War until 1976 was cut down the size of government, start shutting down government programs. And it never particularly sold, because people want those programs. The American people like Social Security. They like there to be federal insurance for our banking system, the FDIC. They like the fact that it's possible to buy a home with federally insured mortgages. They like the veterans' benefits that they get. They like the fact that the federal government is in some way helping them get an education and maintaining the schools, that there is federal money coming into the states for everything from bridges and roads to public education. They like that. So how do you be the party of cutting popular programs and stay in power when it's the opposite of what most people want? Well, Jude Wodinski came up with this theory. It's called the two Santa Claus theory. And what he said was, basically, you'll never appeal to voters by being the Scrooge, by being the party that says that we're going to spend less money. Never can do it. The Democrats have always been the Santa Claus. They've been the ones who've been saying, "Yep, we're gonna make sure that everything's fine. We'll take care of you in your old age. Don't worry." And that was you know, they were the Santa Claus. So he said the Republicans have to become the double Santa Claus. They've got to become the Santa Claus too, only even more so. So instead of talking about cutting back on government programs, instead talk about how growing the economy will help everybody. Everybody will get richer. And you grow the economy by cutting back the revenue going to government. You never talk about the fact that that means then you will have a rationale for doing away with Medicare and privatizing Social Security and all these other things. You never talk about that, because then you wouldn't be Santa Claus. In 1999, the Cato Institute founder and president Ed Crane wrote a memo. He said, when Jack Kemp, Newt Gingrich, Vin Weber, Connie Mack, and the rest discovered Jude Wodinski and Art Laffler, and this is the two Santa Claus theory, they thought they'd died and gone to heaven. In supply-side economics, they found a philosophy that gave them a free pass out of the debate over the proper role of government. Just cut taxes and grow the economy. Government will shrink as a percentage of GDP, even if you don't cut spending. That's why you rarely, if ever, hear Kemp and Gingrich call for spending cuts, much less the elimination of programs and departments, even though that's ultimately their goal. So that's the history. Now here's the present. Today's Wall Street Journal, page four in the first section. Article by Yoki Driesen. The headlines, Why Some Republicans Want to Lose. Now, see, what I see coming down the road is after this election, there's going to be some really seriously bad economic times, because the Bushies have set us up for a series of disasters. They want to be Santa Claus. They don't want to be the guys who are the Scrooge, who's saying, hey, bad economic times, 26 years of conservative economic policies thrown our economy in the toilet. So anyhow, here's the article by Driesen. He says, as the White House and its Republican allies on Capitol Hill work to retain control of Congress in November's election, a small but vocal band of conservative iconoclasts say they would prefer to see their own party lose. He says, the argument is that it would be better for the country if their party lost and some plan to vote Democratic for the first time in their lives. Fiscal hawks, for example, are furious about the growth of the federal government. Some are upset that Congress allowed Bush to claim expansive powers. But other Republicans couch their desire for Republican losses in political terms, arguing the Democratic control of Congress for at least 2 years would increase the chances of Republicans retaining the presidency in 2008 by giving Republican candidates high-profile Democratic targets. You get this? If the Democrats take control of the House or Senate in 2006, then in 2008, the Republicans will be able to say, oh, it was those Democrats who brought you bad times. Elect us. We're Santa Claus. 45 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
There's a dark and the troubled side of life. There's a bright and a sunny side too. Though we meet with the darkness and strife, the sunny side we also may view.
Keep on the sunny side.
And welcome back. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on 9 minutes before the hour. Just past 10 minutes. Now it's nine. Bruce Bartlett, a Treasury Department official during the presidency of Mr. Bush's father. This piece in today's Wall Street Journal. Referring to the top-ranking Democrats in the House and Senate, he says, giving these inept leaders high profiles would be a gift to conservatives everywhere. He's saying the best thing that could happen for the Republicans is if the Democrats take the House and Senate. Now, there may be some funny cross currents here. I mean, this is a guy who works for Bush Sr. And if the Democrats take the House and Senate, Bush Jr. will probably get impeached. So would Bush Sr. want that to happen? Maybe. Maybe he thinks his son has betrayed America. Who knows? But here's the quote in today's Wall Street Journal from Bruce Bartlett, a Treasury Department official during the presidency of George Herbert Walker Bush. He says, and I quote, he's speaking about right now. He says, every Republican I know thinks Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are the best things they have going for them. Giving these inept leaders higher profiles would be a gift to conservatives everywhere, he wrote in an essay, part of a series of conservatives published recently in Washington Monthly magazine under the heading Time for Us to Go. There's a whole series of conservatives who are saying, time for the Republicans to lose power. Joe Scarborough, for example, Republicans need a wake-up call. He says, we ran in 1994 against runaway spending, exploding deficits and corruption, but with Republicans in charge of both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, what do we have? Same runaway spending, record deficits, and culture of corruption. Therefore, implicitly, what he's suggesting is, let's let the Democrats take power for 2 years so we can blame it all on them. What an interesting strategy. This is, you know, I just find this fascinating, this whole piece. There's, you know, some Republicans, by contrast, having tasted congressional power for 12 years now and control of the House, the Senate, the White House for nearly six, are ready to try being the opposition. You get this? They don't want to be the party in power. Why? Because they don't want to be held responsible for the housing bubble bursting. For all the disasters that George W. has brought us. And the healthcare system is melting down. The middle class is getting screwed. We got an occupation in Iraq that's a disaster. A bellicose foreign policy. Mr. Fine, the former Reagan and Nixon appointee, describes himself as a longtime conservative, a lifelong conservative, who has voted for Republican candidates all his life and is disgusted by Democratic support for affirmative action. But he says that congressional Republicans have forfeited their right to control both chambers. Now, here's a guy who's doing this on principle. By failing to confront Mr. Bush over his expression of executive power, his interpretation of due process and habeas corpus, and his willingness to ignore legislation that he sees as an infringement of his war-fighting powers. Yeah. Mr. Fenn recently bought a home in Florida and says he is scrambling to register to vote there in November, where he plans to do something he's never done before, cast a ballot for a Democrat. In fact, he says he's going to vote for Christine Jennings, who's running against who's running to fill the House seat vacated by Catherine Harris. He's all excited about this. We have Republicans writing in the Wall Street Journal and writing in a series in Washington Monthly Magazine about how they think that the Democrats should take control for a couple of years. I'm telling you, this is Jude Waninsky's toque Santa Claus theory. You've got to give up power for a little while so that you can claim to be Santa Claus and get it back. If you hold on to it and things go to hell, you can't claim to be Santa Claus. Every time the Democrats hold power, things seem to go very well, thank you very much. Whenever the Republicans get power, what do you get? You get the Great Depression. You get the Nixon recession, which echoed even into Jimmy Carter's presidency. You get the Reagan recession. Remember the Reagan recession? It was terrible until he started deficit spending like crazy, you know, running off the national credit card like a drunken sailor. So, you know, expect to see some strange things coming up this fall, some very strange things. Interesting. Ed in San Juan Capistrano, California. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind? We have about a minute before we've got to wrap up the show, by the way.
Okay, why can't we reframe this war in Iraq? It's not a war,
it's an occupation.
The occupation, I'm sorry. But it's a religious war that we started. It's Sunni.
Well, it's a religious war that we've unleashed.
We unleashed it just like Ireland with the Protestant and Catholic.
Sure. Sure,
why
absolutely.
Can't we start framing it as that? Is that it's Bush's religious war, and try to wake up the Muslims as to what's going on.
Well, part of the problem is that because Saddam Hussein was a secularist, and he believed in a secular society, he was not just allowing but encouraging Sunnis to move into Shia areas and Shia to move into Sunni areas, and trying to reduce the power of ethnic blocs in his country. He saw that as a challenge to his own power. And so now you've got this integration where these folks are saying, hey, we don't want to be integrated. We're going to fight with each other and kill each other. Yeah, good point. Good point. Thanks for the call. Tomorrow I'll be debating conservative Marlo Lewis about global warming. She's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Yeah, it should be interesting. And Patricia Madrid is here, our candidate for our Taking Our Country Back segment. That and more, and your calls tomorrow. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.